Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Today we speak with author Nicholas Mann. He's the author of many books, but we focus in on his book, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C. But first, let's look at some of the stories in other news. Here's one on National Public Radio. Senate joins House in condemning United Nations Agenda 21. Tennessee Senate added its voice to the State House in condemning the United Nations Agenda 21 on Tuesday. The program is an environmental initiative meant to encourage sustainable development. A majority of Tennessee lawmakers now describe it as destructive. This connects back to last week's show with Pauline Cantwell, who was the guest, and she runs the website aworldalert.com. The article continues, the United Nations agenda has never been endorsed by the U.S. as a treaty, but it's become a hot-button issue among grassroots conservatives who see the United Nations as the first step to so-called one-world government. Resolution sponsor Mike Bell, a Republican from McMinn County, held up a black loose-leaf folder several inches thick, and there's his quote. There's over 300 pages, like I said, contained in this document. I can best describe this as zoning rules on steroids. Chattanooga Democrat Andy Burke says the resolution implies that simple environmental planning is a conspiracy to remove Americans' property rights. And his quote is, it seems to me that planning and forethought and trying to preserve our Tennessee way of life is exactly what we should be doing. Burke pointed to the planning which the city of Chattanooga had to do when it lured the large Volkswagen plant to the region. The measure has no practical effect, sponsor Mike Bell called it. I want to remind listeners that Agenda 21 is coming in on the local level, as we discussed in the past show. Here's another story on Washington's blog. 84% of all stock trades are by high-frequency computers. Only 16% of all stock trades are done by human traders. As of 2010, 50 to 70% of all stock trades were done by high-frequency trading computer algorithms. And many other asset classes are dominated by high-frequency trading as well. High-frequency trading distorts the markets and it lets the big banks peek at what the real traders are buying and selling and then the trade on the insider information. Morgan Stanley has just shown in the Financial Times that the percentage of high-frequency trading in the stock market has skyrocketed to 84%. Here's a story on the Food Freedom News. Another way to kill U.S. farmers: seize their bank accounts on phony charges. Monsanto's Food and Drug Administration can't close down small dairies and private food clubs fast enough. Bursting on the scene with guns drawn, as if criminalized right to contract for natural foods we've consumed for millennia deserves SWAT attention. Remember that Monsanto and Blackwater, now known as ZXE, have teamed up. Obama has the Department of Justice going after small farmers under the post-9/11 Bank Secrecy Act, which makes it a crime to deposit less than $10,000 when you earned more than that. The level we deposited was what it was, and it was about the same every week, Randy Sowers told Frederick News. The Sowers and Run South Mountain Creamery in Middletown, Maryland. Admittedly, when the Sowers earned more than $10,000 in February, they learned that they'd have to fill out paperwork at the bank for such large deposits. They simply rolled the deposits over to keep them below the none of your effing business amount, rather than waste time on bureaucratic red tape aimed at flagging terrorism or other illegal activities. The article continues. Here's one more Agenda 21 article. It's an editorial by John Rhodes. Agenda 21 threatens private property rights. Having never been one to subscribe to conspiracy theories, I came kicking and screaming into the dangers of Agenda 21. Until now, I'm sure you've never heard of it. It's a stealth and insidious radical environmentalist attack on our private property rights, sovereignty, and the very foundations of our freedoms. It is here in South Mississippi. Pascagoula is now contemplating adoption under the banner Comprehensive Plan. Notice how they're changing the names of these policies and plans. To say the least, it cannot be explained in 300 words or less. Therefore, I hope to whet your appetite enough to get you to do some research on your own. In short, it seeks to confiscate your home ownership control away from you and give it to the government. The Republic National Committee, the National Federation of Republican Assemblies, the Tennessee General Assembly, and other states and many Democratic organizations, such as Democrats Against Agenda 21, have denounced it as dangerous to our freedoms. Yes, your home may be targeted for elimination by Agenda 21 and sustainable development. Agenda 21 states, quote, property ownership is social injustice. Owning rural land or a single-family home must be eliminated in favor of promoting the collective via high-density, compact, multi-story apartment complexes in a central city setting. Unbelievably, some of our local municipalities have adopted this code, and your home and land ownership may be in danger. Here's another story. World's Biggest Fracker Pockets $1 Billion in Shady Deal by Jeff Goodell. It's in the Rolling Stone. He writes, in March, I wrote a long article about the fracking boom for Rolling Stone, focusing on Chesapeake Energy, whose CEO, Aubrey McClendon, proudly boasted to me, we're the biggest frackers in the world. The story raised questions about the financial underpinnings of the company and suggested that today's natural gas boom is likely to be a short-lived euphoria driven by new drilling technology and corporate greed. Well, this morning, Reuters hit with an important story revealing that the financial shenanigans at Chesapeake are even more complicated than anyone knew. And, as always, McClendon is right in the middle of it. Here's part of the Reuters article. McClendon has borrowed as much as $1.1 billion in the last 3 years by pledging his stake in the company's oil and natural gas wells as collateral. The loans were made through three companies controlled by McClendon that list Chesapeake's headquarters as their address. The money is being used to help finance what could be a lucrative perk of his job, the opportunity to buy into the very same well stakes that he's using as a collateral for the borrowings. This story, he writes, caused Chesapeake's stock to tank as much as 10% during the day and made it one of the most actively traded stocks on Wall Street. The article continues on talking about the long history of financial recklessness connected to McClendon. Many listeners may have already heard this story. It's on the Activist Post by Anthony Guicciardi. Mother wins top environmental award for beating Monsanto after experiencing the traumatizing death of her daughter to kidney failure just 3 days after her daughter was born. Sofia Gattaca from Argentina became determined to find out what killed her daughter. Her conclusion, Monsanto's genetically modified soy fields that surrounded her neighborhood, laced with damaging insecticides, negatively affecting nearby neighborhood children and adults alike. Gattaca began to detail how her small town was plagued with astronomically high birth defect rates, respiratory disease, and even infant mortality. From this point, the courageous mother decided to take on Monsanto. Amazingly, she's not alone in her struggle against the biotechnology colossus when it comes to causing birth problems, as a large group of farmers, also from Argentina, launched a lawsuit against Monsanto for causing devastating birth defects in children. Gattaca was initially alone, however, when she first began her uphill battle. But now she is not. Forming a group of concerned mothers in her local area after hosting an event at her home to discuss her experiences, the mother would be one of very few as actually beat Monsanto. Argentina's Supreme Court not only banned chemical spraying near populated areas, but demanded that the government, as well as soy manufacturers, now prove that these chemicals are safe. When we discussed the ley lines of New York City, it was based on Peter Schempo's work. He took some time to map out and identify specific energy lines based around areas in the landscape such as rivers, roads, and natural corridors. Peter located the Nexus near the Statue of Liberty, an area where the ley line energies radiate out from a single point of focus. A topic that past guest, Matthew Deluz, referenced as well. Author Nicholas Mann joins us now to discuss his book, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C. Nicholas examines the original maps of the American capital city. After the War of Independence, the layout was initially designed using golden section geometry, and the pentacles were based on the flower of life. However, the early harmonious geometric ratio of the layout, based on the golden section, was later distorted. The changes caused bitter conflicts amid Freemasons and the original designer. Our guest, Nicholas Mann, is the author of many books on geomancy, mythology, and sacred geometry. He's written about other locations, such as Glastonbury, England, Sedona, Arizona, and his website is britishmysteries.co.uk. Nicholas Mann, welcome to In Other News.
Thanks.
We had talked in a previous show about ley lines or identifying ley lines in New York City, and our guest, Peter Champeau, had identified the nexus near the Statue of Liberty. You've pointed out in your book, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C., the nexus or the center point is at the Capitol building. There's certainly a history to that that you write about in the book. Could you describe that to listeners?
Well, friends of mine always said to me, oh, you'd be really interested in studying the early history of Washington, D.C., because you're interested in alignments and so on. And, of course, the city was designed by Masons. But nobody could point me to any of the material that would substantiate that. And I had some free time on my hands. And I had about 6 months. This was way back in 1993, when I was living in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg. Mm-hmm. And I would pop down to D.C. for the weekend and conduct research. So that was the way to do it, just come and take a look for myself. And what turned up was that the original design for the capital city of the United States was by a French architect known as Pierre-Charles L'Enfant. And he was an old friend of George Washington's. They had served together in the War of Independence. He was French. L'Enfant was French. He'd come over on the wave of idealism that so many people experienced in France during the Revolution, and it gave them a chance to fight the British in the States and this time be victorious. Mm-hmm. So after the War of Independence and the Constitution of the States was sorted out, George Washington basically commissioned his old pal, his old war comrade, L'Enfant, to design the new federal city. Now, we'll see, I'm sure as we go on, that this brought him into conflict with other interests. You know, Thomas Jefferson was far more pragmatically inclined, whereas L'Enfant had this huge vision of sweeping boulevards and magnificent avenues that very much based upon the European model. Jefferson was much more interested in the budget, in the economy, and getting the books to match up. Mm. But this wasn't going to stop L'Enfant. And besides, he had the president, Washington, standing right behind him, giving him support. So he went down to the area on the Potomac. This is late in 1793. He did the original surveys for the city. And, of course, what he had was a tabula rasa, an empty landscape. Well, almost empty. You know, the town of Georgetown was down the creek. There were farms, there were roads. But he pretty much had an empty landscape with which to work. And he let his imagination run free. And I believe that what he did, first of all, was highly significant in that he established, if you like, the sacred center of the capital of the new United States city. And he found the center, was a place that he felt was to be the center. He declared that it should be the new zero meridian.
Nicholas, how did he find this?
Well, he looked at the landscape, and it wasn't a particularly inspiring landscape. You know, there were no particularly dramatic hills or rivers. You had the big Potomac, the Anacostia River, and these rolling hills. But he picked a hill called Jenkins Hill in the middle of the site, and he declared this was to be the new center.
Was it an arbitrary decision, or was it based on maybe magnetic lines or astronomy?
All of the above. He looked at it, and he thought, you know, this is the only site that works. You've got the views down the Potomac, for a start. You've got the views to the hills all around and up the different rivers. And, well, interestingly, the hill, known as Jenkins Hill, was considered to be an old Indian meeting place. It was considered to be a council place where the different tribes of the area met. And I thought that was interesting.
Oh, yes, that's a very critical point.
The fact that the native people of the area had already marked that site out as a crucial point for political debate and for resolution. And, of course, there is this fantastic story that I don't think we'll have time to go into here about the treaty oak and the white woman who was captured and imprisoned under its branches. But maybe more on that later.
Okay.
Back to Jenkins Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And what L'Enfant did in this incredible masterstroke was to say that the new zero meridian of longitude should go through Jenkins Hill. So instead of the Greenwich meridian through Greenwich in London defining the zero degree of longitude, the new center of the United States was to define, literally, the new center of the Earth. And he got the surveyor, Ellicott, a black man called Benjamin Banneker, involved in surveying this new center of the United States. Fascinating stuff.
Oh, yes. Extremely fascinating. When you say the new center, are you saying the center of the New World?
I think that's how he saw it. I think he saw the United States as being the New World. You know, Novus Ordo Seclorum was a very, very big concept at that time. You know, this was to be the center of the new order, the new world order.
Yes, it goes all the way back. I wanted to ask you about the significance of looking down the Potomac River and the geometric placement within the main branch of the river. You had pointed out, I believe, with the Pythagoras geometry of the Y.
Yes. Well, there's actually a couple of points to consider here. The first is the federal district. Congress, well, the Constitution allowed for the creation of the federal district. And this came into being through an act of Congress that allowed a 10-mile square area to be defined. And Washington pretty much decided this was to be on the Potomac shore. Well, the way the Potomac lies at this point, running north-south, allowed a fantastic view downstream. You know, the Potomac opens up at this point, eventually into Chesapeake Bay. And there was a point downriver that allowed them to anchor the southernmost point of the square, the 10-mile square, of the federal district. But interestingly, instead of aligning it, as you would imagine, as a square, north, south, east, west, it was aligned so it pointed north, south, east, west. So when you look at it on a map, it's like a diamond.
I saw that in your illustrations, and I just want to remind listeners we're talking with author and lecturer Nicholas Mann, who is the author of many books, but the one we're speaking about is titled The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C., extremely detailed. The subtitle is The Integrity and Power of the Original Design. Instead of a square, it's a diamond.
Comes out to be a diamond, and Ellicott and Banneker surveyed the boundaries of the Federal District, and they laid out milestones along each of the boundaries. And it's interesting that if you draw lines across the square of the Federal District, they intersect at a point, so you could say this was the center of the Federal District, just south and west of the White House, in the courtyard of the Pan Am building, the Pan American Unity building, which I find fascinating. And in fact, in the exact center of the Federal District, there's a little courtyard with a statue of an Aztec deity known as Xochipilli, mm-hmm. or the god of the flowers, which I think is just a lovely touch that you've got this Pan-American sacred presence in the middle of the Federal District.
Why is that fascinating to you?
Well, I think what is going on here is that at the time of the foundation of the United States, there was a coming together of extremely high idealism and quite intense and revolutionary spirituality. People crossed the Atlantic for many reasons, but one of them was because of prohibitions, the inability to practice their religion in their own country. And, you know, freedom of religion was one of the main constitutional principles of the United States. But it was combined with this incredibly high idealism, the ideals of liberty, equality, fraternity, and democracy. You know, people believed in those concepts during those heady days after the War of Independence. And I think that L'Enfant just captured this energy and put it into his design for the city. I don't think he was able to articulate it that well. And if he had, I think it would have been too controversial. You know, Jefferson, with his secular idealism, wanted nothing to do with the spiritual ideal. But many people did.
You had put a template of L'Enfant's design over ancient areas such as Stonehenge and Luxor. Can you tell me the significance of that?
Right. We've looked at the Federal District and discussed that as a square or a diamond. Mm-hmm. Now we need to look closely at L'Enfant's design. And after he placed the main buildings, the Capitol at the center, and then he had to locate the White House, the seat of the executive, and the Supreme Court, the seat of the judiciary. And he found locations for these three main centers, as well as other important centers, and then he ran avenues between them. And it's from those avenues, the diagonals that jump out at you when you look at a map of Washington, D.C. today.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
The geometry emerges. And it's this original geometry that I analyzed. So I looked at the first maps that L'Enfant created for the design of the city. And the geometry is clear and unmistakable. It jumps out at you as being golden section geometry. Now, the golden section is the phi, or the golden mean ratio, said to be the most harmonious ratio. The Greeks used it in the construction of their temples. So did the ancient Egyptians. And that's why I could take a template of L'Enfant's plan and lay it over the Temple of Luxor in Egypt. And you could see a harmony between the two sets of proportions. I was also able to do the same with Stonehenge, because that too was laid out according to golden section geometry. Now, the thing about golden section geometry is that it's the geometry of the natural world. It's the geometry that unfolds in the Fibonacci series, in numbers, and you find that in the ratios of proportion in our bodies. Leonardo da Vinci showed it in that famous drawing of his Vitruvian Man, the man spread out inside of a circle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also present in the ratios of plants and shells. The Nautilus shell shows the golden section geometry in its beautiful spiral. So I think what Longform was doing in basing the federal city upon the golden section design was bringing the ideals of the people in harmony with the land. He wanted to tap into the power of the landscape itself, bring the United States and its idealism down to earth, ground it in the landscape, and in that way actually bring enormous power. Because after all, at that time, Americans hardly knew how great their country was going to become. I don't think Jefferson had even made the Louisiana Purchase at this point. The interior, the West, wasn't even mapped. By defining the new center of the new world and laying these avenues out to radiate out across the entire continent, L'Enfant was bringing the new land into the new order, the new secular world order. And, you know, this meant enormous power, incredible power was tapped into by the United States.
Oh, indeed. And there's one significant shape that I often see within the landscape of some of this geometry, and it resembles the key, the part on the basketball court you stand to shoot a basket if there's a penalty. They call it the key.
Oh, yes.
I see that replicated in various architectural layouts of particular areas and institutions. Could you talk about the significance of that?
It's a way of resolving the different orders of architecture. You could look at it numerologically, and if you can bridge different orders, for example, the ratios of 5 and 6. The ratio of 5 is the ratio of the golden section. This is the number of the natural world. We have 5 fingers, 5 toes, 5 limbs, 5 sensory organs, and so on. Whereas if the number of the people is a very democratic number, whereas the number 6 is a solar number, it's the number of power, it's the number of the sun. So by resolving 5 and 6 and their associated patterns, you get the key to harmonizing these different principles. And in this case, the key was to harmonize the democratic center, the new center of government, Congress, democratic house, with leadership, with the executive. So the presidential numbers associated with the grid, the sixfold pattern of the grid, were meant to harmonize with the circular patterns of the people. And L'Enfant did this, I think, brilliantly with this keyhole pattern, if you like.
Thank you for explaining that. Nicholas Mann could not take calls this evening. We'll be right back after this break. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Nicholas Mann, and we're talking with him about one of his books, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C. It also leads to what Jefferson did afterward in altering the symbolic balance of power. He moved the New World Order marker, you had pointed out, and can you describe what exactly happened here?
Well, L'Enfant put the Capitol building, Congress, at the center of his design. And this was to be the center of the city and the center of America. And all the avenues named after the states were to radiate out from here. Other avenues were meant to radiate outwards from the White House. Now, what happened was that the design was so big and cumbersome and expensive that Jefferson was really having none of it. He cut the plan, L'Enfant was sacked, Ellicott, the engineer, was made the designer, and the Ellicott plan is really the plan that has come into being today. And that fact, and then what happened subsequently with the creation of the Mall, with Washington Monument at the middle of it, meant that instead of the city radiating outwards, the city was turned inwards to look upon itself. And if you imagine the Mall for a moment, you'll see this. All the great buildings of the city, the Lincoln Memorial, the Jefferson Memorial, the White House, the Capitol building, they all look inwards into the Mall to the obelisk of the Washington Monument at their center. This was a long process, and you can't lay it solely at the door of Jefferson, though he started that process off. And you can't blame the engineers for pragmatic solutions that were needed, you know, in terms of the budget. But the effect was that all the symbolic markers of the city all became concentrated upon the Federal Triangle, that area between the Capitol, the White House, and the Washington Monument. And the city, instead of looking outwards, was turned inwards to look upon itself. And, of course, the Washington Monument, that phenomenal obelisk in the middle, is a symbol not of democracy, but of single executive monopolization of power.
It started way back then.
It was really unfortunate. The Washington Monument was the opportunity for the Masons to really let, you know, all their symbolism come out, all their numerology come out. The tower, the obelisk is 555 feet. And almost 6 inches high. So you've got 555.5 feet in height.
That chapter is really amazing in your book, by the way.
You round that out to inches, and you get 6,660. So So you've got the 555 and the 666 symbolism coming in there,
mm-hmm.
but you get the triumph of the 6 over the 5. In effect, what you get is the top-heavy executive, the focus on presidential power, on federal power, at the expense of the states and the people in the symbolism of the city.
The metaphorical symbolism is truly amazing in that you've been able to work it out with numerology and the architecture is really a feat. And that's in this book that we're discussing now with author Nicholas Mann, The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C. In that chapter on the Washington Monument, I noticed the other number that you pointed out was 1080. And you often see that now with high-definition technology, 1080i integrated 1080p. Is there any connection there?
Huh. I've never thought of that before. 1080 is the feminine number. It's the number of, it's a lunar number, as opposed to the solar number of 6 or 60 or 666. So where 1080 comes in, it's an attempt to harmonize the numbers and the symbolism of the sun and the moon.
Oh, I got you. Okay, that's very important. With the Washington Monument and the Freemasons and the symbolism and related conspiracy and, of course, 666 and the inverted pentagrams, do you often get the question about the evil presence and negativity, and are you often asked about the satanic agenda?
You know, that does come up. And actually, I can't find evidence of it. I know there was a lot of suspicion of the Masons, and I looked closely just to see how much the Masons were involved in the design of the city. And again and again, it was very, very hard to find, an interested agenda. What came up again and again in the city and in your wonderful country was the money. Decisions so often just came down to solving an engineering problem or dealing with a budget. So no, I couldn't really come up with anything. The most problematic thing I think I came up with, apart from turning the city outside in, so it became introverted, as it were, was something that happened just north of the White House. There, two avenues were meant to radiate outwards north from the White House at an angle of 60 degrees, which was a number of harmony and proportion. They were closed. The angle of the avenues was changed to much less than that. And in geomancy, the number they achieved is known as the deadly arrow. So that instead of this open, expansive energy radiating north from the White House, there is, in geomantic terms, a deadly arrow pointing at the White House. Hmm. And right in the middle of the deadly arrow sits a Masonic temple. at the top of the what could be construed as a pyramid.
Is that the Scottish Rite Temple?
Yes, the Scottish Rite Temple on S Street.
I had visited that building. It is something to behold.
It's an amazing building. That is an exercise in harmonizing those different systems I talked about earlier, mm-hmm. harmonizing the different ratios and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked hard, and I've analyzed the question in some detail in my book. And I think in the end, it was an engineer's pragmaticism coming out on top of an idealistic vision rather than there being any attempt to control or monopolize power.
I just thought I'd ask about that specifically because of the numerology, the 666, the inverted pentagrams, and all of the symbols related to cultural ideas of Satanism and evil associated with some secret societies, which makes it significant, especially with this particular type of work. Thank you for answering that. I really appreciate that. You had dug in deep into the Masonic libraries. Can you tell listeners a little bit about the research you had to do to get this information into this book?
Well, I must say that as the listener has probably gathered by now, I am not an American. I'm British, and I was educated in a British university. Many times I would go down to the British Museum in London and try and get information, and it was incredibly difficult to get the access I wanted. When I went to Washington, D.C., and I went to the Library of Congress for the first time, I went to the library, and I asked for various books, and within minutes, they were produced. And not only the books, but the original copies. And at times, I was looking at documents that were, if not written by Jefferson, were annotated by him, originals.
Wow.
And I couldn't believe the availability of information that the Library of Congress made possible. You know, the Freedom of Information Act was a fantastic thing. And I experienced the same thing at the Masonic temples. The 33rd degree Masons I met were only too happy to give me access to their libraries, to allow me to look at their books that were on the library shelves or in some cases weren't, and to explain some of their work. So the availability of information was truly wonderful. I think what struck me behind the work, you know, we've talked about some kind of demonic influence, which perhaps I would characterize more as bungling and incompetence and chaos. Apart from that, there was something much more benign. And again, this symbol of the divine feminine kept on coming up in the work. And as I'm sure all your listeners are aware, on the top of the Capitol building is a bronze statue of Lady Liberty. Beautiful sculpture. Its sister, the Statue of Liberty, of course, stands in New York Harbor. And these are representations of a divine feminine figure who was very much in people's minds in the 17th and 18th centuries, known as Columbia. She was an embodiment of the new spirit of the land. And of course, you know, you go to the movies today and you see a picture, a movie by Columbia Pictures, and there she is on her pedestal with her her flame. And she's a powerful motif to have over the capital city. And she comes up in the early mythology of the city and in the Native American mythology of the place. There's something very benign in her imagery.
You had pointed out in the book, or rather uncovered, L'Enfant's conflict with the Freemasons in the design and layout, the original designs. Can you tell listeners a little bit about what was going on there?
Well, you know, I don't think I ever really got to the bottom of it. I discovered after the book was published that L'Enfant was initiated as a Freemason. He only took the first 3 degrees, and it does go up to 33 degrees. But I think what happened was that he came into conflict with them. He was a visionary. He was an idealist. I want to portray L'Enfant as a romantic, whereas the Masons of that time were very much concerned with ownership, with property development, and so on. Where Longfong came into conflict with the Masons was over the conflict of interest. He wanted a grand avenue. The Masons wanted subdivisions that could be sold and a profit made. So if a Mason had put up a house that was in contradiction to his plan, Longfong would order it to be torn down. So he was coming up against the pragmatic interests of the Masons again and again and again. And I like to think of Longfong as part of the beginning of the Romantic movement in the United States. Of course, the Romanticists were all the thing in Europe at that time. Robespierre in the French Revolution, and of course in Britain you get the Romantic poets, Coleridge, Shelley, all fascinated by the French Revolution and by what was going on in the States. And Longfong was fired up by this Romantic vision. And he took it over to the States and was one of the first to really ground that idea that in nature itself was something sublime, that in nature were the principles of truth and beauty and justice and peace, things that perhaps we would have attributed to a transcendent force. He was willing to impute to the landscape. And of course, this flourished over the following decades. The Romantic movement just took off across the States. As people investigated the interior of the United States, Romantic ideals came back, you know, these paintings of incredible mountains, descriptions of vast rivers and plains. And, of course, eventually you get the writings of Thoreau and Walt Whitman, who embody that principle of the sacred being an immanent presence, that place itself has divine or sacred power. And I think Longfong, though he never articulated that, was the forerunner of that idea. He struck his shingle, his post, down in the center of the New World. And in defining this as the new center, released the cathonic energies, the earth energies of the landscape itself. So these golden section patterns emerge in the city in this very natural and very beautiful way.
It's very eloquently put, Nicholas. Now, however, you had pointed out that this initial geometric ratio had been distorted, and we're looking at a different feel in that area now. But you have that chapter, Avenue of the Stars. Has that been left alone, that work that was connected to astronomy?
Well, there is, of course, a connection between the terrestrial and the heavenly. It's always there. The same patterns that we find on Earth, we find in the heavens. And the goal of a good geomancer, of a good architect, is to bring those heavenly patterns down to Earth and embody them in the landscape. And there's no doubt that the original American ideals had heavenly components. The signing of the Declaration of Independence and the ratification of the Constitution were delayed to auspicious dates so that the power of Sirius, for example, could be harnessed. There were clearly astrologers at work in those days of the late 18th century. And it was believed that the avenues of Washington, D.C. Were aligned to certain stars, such as Regulus, the princely star in the heart of Leo. I think the idea was, with the design of the city and the architecture and the bringing in of zodiacs into the architecture, was to make that harmonization of heaven and earth complete. I'm really encouraged that in the new revisions that are now taking place in the city, that they refer again and again to the integrity of the original design. That L'Enfant's design, in its original vision, was the best design that could have been laid down on the landscape. And that by returning to that vision, the ideals upon which the United States was founded can again be tapped into and released. So they're talking of opening up the avenues, of turning the city around to look outwards again, moving the new monuments and memorials out from the mall, which is now congested, out into different parts of the city.
I didn't know this.
Yes, there's a plan. I think it's called the Legacy Plan. They've been going for some time, and they've got quite a budget behind them to turn the city around, as it were. Turn it inside out.
And oh, that's very interesting. And so you see it going back to L'Enfant's plan.
I do. I'm very, very positive. For example, I don't know if this will work, but when you think of the Capitol building, most people think it looks in to the mall, but it doesn't. The Capitol building, its front door, looks away from the mall. It looks outward down to Lincoln Square. And it's as though that outward movement has been blocked. So what they plan to do is reopen by taking the monuments back out to Lincoln Square and beyond and opening up the Anacostia Basin. They can take the energy concentrated into the center of the city back out through what has become in many cases poor neighborhoods, neighborhoods where, you know, lack of opportunity, and in that way open up the city again and solve some of these problems. It's a good vision, and I hope it's successful.
Nicholas Mann, his website is britishmysteries.co.uk. And Nicholas, can you tell listeners what you're doing now?
Oh, I've gone in a very different direction. I've just produced a study of Avebury Stone Circle. And Avebury is the big sister of Stonehenge. It's a stone circle about 20 miles north of Stonehenge and about 20 times the size. So built 5,000 years ago before the pyramids in Egypt. And I've done an astronomical study to show that our ancient ancestors were looking at the heavens.
Oh, that's wonderful. That sounds fantastic. The Sacred Geometry of Washington, D.C. I have not seen any other book that compares to it in the amount of detail and research that you've put into it. I want to thank you for being on In Other News. It's been truly a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.